the summer of 1793, the French Revolution was entering its fourth year, and France was on the verge of anarchy. In Paris, political extremists had seized control of the revolution. They guillotined the king, and imposed a reign of terror that dealt summary justice to all suspected enemies of the revolution. Hoping to unify the new republic, France's leaders had declared war on the Habsburg Empire. But the conflict quickly widened, and soon France was facing the combined might of Europe's leading powers, determined to stamp out her dangerous political experiment. Meanwhile, whole regions of France had come out in open revolt, horrified by the new extremism of the revolution. In August, the Republic suffered a further, potentially fatal blow, when the city of Toulon joined the revolt. Toulon was France's largest and most important naval base in the south, home to a third of the entire French navy. But now, rebels welcomed their old enemy, the British Royal Navy, into the port, led by Admiral Lord Hood, aboard HMS Victory. It was an extraordinary coup. Without a shot being fired, the Allies had crippled French naval power in the Mediterranean, and gained a vital toehold on the French coast. All French forces in the area were immediately diverted to face this new threat, and lay siege to the rebel port. 19,000 troops in all. But since most French officers had been aristocrats, who were now fleeing the revolution in large numbers, they were seriously short of professional leadership. Their commander, General Jean-François Carteau, was a loyal Republican, but a court painter by trade, with no military training. To make matters worse, one of his few professional officers, his artillery commander, Colonel Dommartin, had been badly wounded on the approach to Toulon. Antoine Salicetti, a Corsican deputy of the National Convention in Paris, recommended as his replacement a fellow countryman, a 24-year-old artillery officer who was passing Toulon en route to the front, named Napoleone Buonaparte, or Bonaparte. Bonaparte was a professional soldier, but he'd seen almost no active service. Nevertheless, Salicetti was impressed by his manner, and most of all, his politics. Bonaparte had just written a political pamphlet, a short story about a young artillery officer who berates his fellow diners for their disloyalty to the Republic. General Carteau thought it wise to accept Deputy Salicetti's recommendation. Many French citizens of Toulon were desperate to escape aboard the Allied ships, knowing that the Republicans would inflict terrible reprisals on the city. British and Spanish ships took as many as they could, about 14,000 in all, but scores were drowned amid chaotic and desperate scenes. Others were left to face the wrath of the revolution. Republican troops entered the city the next morning, and executions and firing squads began almost immediately. For the next 2 weeks, about 200 were executed every day. Allied propaganda later blamed Bonaparte for the atrocities, but there's no evidence he was directly involved. France's young republic was now fighting back on all fronts. And with the fall of Toulon, the Allies had lost a golden opportunity, a chance to stir up further revolt, deal a lasting blow to French naval power, perhaps even overturn the revolution. But instead, the French Republic had weathered one of its greatest storms. In no small part, thanks to the remarkable judgment, energy and courage of one 24-year-old artillery officer, now promoted Brigadier General in recognition of his extraordinary service at Toulon. Napoleon Bonaparte had taken his first step on the path to greatness. And for Europe, 21 years of almost constant war awaited.
Observing the constant violence, bloodshed, and disorder in the new French Republic, Napoleon begins to study the causes of the tragic revolution. Napoleon concludes that the revolution was caused and carried out by a group known as the Jacobins, who have operated in secret through Masonic lodges. To bring back order, Napoleon sends agents to infiltrate and spy on Masonic lodges. Shortly thereafter, Napoleon recognizes Freemasonry as a threat to all of Europe. This revelation is what sets off Napoleon's counter-revolutionary conquest. Recognizing the Masonic infiltration of both royalists and revolutionaries, Napoleon will now partake in a crusade to conquer and purge Europe of all Freemasonry. But first, he must take back France and ascend to its throne. To do this, Napoleon plans his own counter-revolution. Unlike the bloodshed caused by the Jacobins in their French Revolution just 10 years prior, Napoleon's counter-revolution would not cost a single drop of blood.
In 1799, Napoleon Bonaparte seized power in France by plotting a coup within another coup. And he did it all without shedding a drop of blood. 1 year before the coup, France was at war with Great Britain, and Russia, Austria, the Ottoman Empire, and some German and Italian states. But Napoleon was focused on Great Britain and wanted to cut off the country's routes to its profitable trading outposts in India. Even though much of his fleet was captured or destroyed by the British at the Battle of the Nile, Napoleon still managed to capture and hold Egypt to cut off British trade routes, and even attack targets deeper into the Ottoman Empire. But back home, the French weren't faring as well, suffering a series of defeats against their European enemies across the first half of 1799. The French people became fed up with their current system of government, known as the Directory, the fourth different system of government since the beginning of the French Revolution 10 years earlier. The Directory system included two legislative bodies, the Council of 500, a chamber of elected men that proposed laws, and the Council of Ancients, 250 elected men over 40 years old that approved laws. The two bodies also worked together to choose the directors themselves, five executives of equal power responsible for enforcing laws. But by 1799, the Directory had brought France into war and near economic ruin. The people largely looked to the country's military for leadership. This is where Napoleon saw his chance. When British ships temporarily retreated from France's ports, Napoleon left Egypt and returned home a hero. Meanwhile, another prominent Frenchman had been plotting to seize power from the weakened Directory. Emmanuel Joseph Cis, better known by his religious title, the Abbé Cis, was elected as a director in May of 1799. He had long been one of the most influential political figures for his writings that partly inspired the French Revolution. But Cis hated the Directory, finding the executive too weak to effectively govern. So soon after Napoleon's return to Paris, the two men met in secret. They agreed to a coup that would allow Cis to place himself at the head of a new government, formed with the help of Napoleon and his loyal army. There were other conspirators, including Minister of Foreign Affairs Talleyrand and Lucien Bonaparte, President of the Council of 500 and Napoleon's younger brother. On the morning of 18 Brumaire, or November 9th, the plan was set into motion. Cis and Lucien Bonaparte informed their respective legislative bodies there was a plot to overthrow the government. But they lied and said it was being led by the Jacobins, the party that had carried out France's reign of terror 5 years earlier. The lawmakers were moved for their safety to a palace in Saint-Cloud, a suburb of France. Conveniently, Napoleon himself was placed in charge of their protection. Meanwhile, three of the five directors had resigned in coordination with the coup. Cis, his ally Roger Ducos, and Paul Barras, a former lover of Napoleon's wife, Josephine. Talleyrand had been given 2 million francs to bribe Barras to resign, but he resigned on his own, so Talleyrand just pocketed the money for himself. The next day, the Council of Ancients were receptive to Napoleon's argument that the government needed to be reorganized, but the Council of 500 needed more convincing. So Napoleon marched into their chamber with grenadiers by his side. The legislators erupted in anger, some charging at Napoleon with daggers. Amidst the chaos, Lucien Bonaparte used the attacks on his brother as an excuse to dissolve the Council of 500. Napoleon's troops dispersed the rest of the council. The Council of Ancients then dissolved the constitution, replacing the directory with three consuls, CIS, Roger Duco, and Napoleon. CIS's coup was complete, but Napoleon was not interested in sharing power. The new government quickly drew up the constitution of the year 8, and Napoleon made sure he was its chief editor. With the new constitution, Napoleon wrested control away from CIS, using his supreme popularity to declare himself first consul, with CIS and Duco secondary in power. Napoleon had succeeded in his coup within a coup, setting himself up to ultimately become dictator, and all without a single life lost.
The War of the Third Coalition started at sea, as the British Admiral Nelson and his French counterpart Villeneuve wrestled for control of the Atlantic and fought the Battle of Trafalgar. However, the land war was more crucial for Napoleon, and the fate of the war was decided during the Battle of the Three Emperors on the snow-perched fields of Austerlitz. French victories at Marengo and Hohenlinden in 1800 forced Austria to sue for a separate peace. The Treaty of Lunéville acknowledged the new French satellites in the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Italy, alongside holdings in Tuscany and the left bank of the River Rhine. Meanwhile, Russian Tsar Paul I was getting closer to Napoleon and even considered a campaign against Britain in India. In 1801, Paul was assassinated by a group of conspirators funded by the British government. The new Tsar, Alexander I, was more lenient towards Britain, but he didn't re-enter the conflict, and in 1802, France and Britain signed a treaty in Amiens that ended the War of the Second Coalition. Despite that, the two countries still had ample reasons to fight, and a year later, Britain declared war again. The initial phase of the conflict that would be known as the War of the Third Coalition took place at sea. Napoleon needed to gain naval dominance to transport 200,000 troops to the British Isles, so the British tried to get rid of the French fleet and that of the new French allies, the Spanish. Other European powers were not eager to join the conflict, but two events changed that. In March of 1804, one of the representatives of the toppled French dynasty of Bourbon, Duke d'Aignan, was seized by the dragoons of Napoleon in the neutral Baden and then executed for treason. The news shocked the royal courts of Europe. In the same year, Napoleon was coronated as the Emperor of the French, and in 1805 as the King of Italy, which meant that he considered himself an equal of the Austrian and Russian emperors.
In December 1804, in the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, Napoleon Bonaparte crowned himself Emperor of the French. Europe had never seen such a sudden and dramatic rise to power. A son of impoverished Corsican nobility to military dictator of France in little more than 10 years. Revolution and war had cleared Napoleon's path to the throne. War would dominate his 10-year reign. A conflict unprecedented in history that would leave millions dead and a continent in turmoil. Eight months after Napoleon's coronation, the French Empire and its Spanish ally were at war with Britain, and Napoleon had assembled an army of 180,000 men along the Channel coast. But as long as the British Royal Navy ruled the seas, invasion was impossible. But nor could Britain challenge France on land. And so British Prime Minister William Pitt tried to build a European coalition against Napoleon, using diplomacy and gold. Britain would prove Napoleon's most steadfast enemy, and its press delighted in relentless mockery of the French Emperor. Britain and France were old rivals, in Europe and overseas. But now, Pitt feared Napoleon's conquests had made France too powerful. The French Emperor had to be defeated, and Europe's balance of power restored, if there was ever to be lasting peace. Pitt found willing allies in Europe, among monarchs who despised Napoleon as a product of the French Revolution and a dangerous threat to the existing order.
The following are excerpts read from the book titled The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin, from the chapter titled The Rothschild Formula. The section titled Napoleon vs. the Bankers states, quote, "If one picture is worth a thousand words, then one example surely must be worth a dozen explanations. There is no better example than the economic war waged by the financiers of 19th century Europe against Napoleon Bonaparte. It is an easily forgotten fact of history that Napoleon had restored law and order to a chaotic post-revolutionary France and had turned his attention not to war, but to establishing peace and improving economic conditions at home. He was particularly anxious to get his country and his people out of debt and out of the control of bankers. One of Napoleon's first blows against the bankers was to establish an independent Bank of France with himself as president, but even this bank was not trusted, and government funds were never placed into it. It was his refusal to borrow, however, that caused the most concern among the financiers. Actually, to them, this was a mixture of both bad and good news. The bad news was that they were denied the benefit of royalty payments on fractional money. The good news was that, without resorting to debt, they were confident Napoleon could not militarily defend himself. Thus, he easily could be toppled and replaced by Louis XVIII of the old monarchic dynasty, who was receptive to banker finance." Wilson continues, quote, "They had good hope of compassing his downfall. None believed that he could finance war on a great scale, now that the resources of paper money had been denied to him by the destruction of the assignat. Where would he obtain the indispensable gold and silver to feed and equip a great army? Pitt, that is the Prime Minister of England, counted already on a coalition of England, Austria, Prussia, Russia, Spain, Sweden, and numerous small states. Some 600,000 men would be put into the field. All the resources of England's wealth, that is to say, of the world's wealth, would be placed at the disposal of this overwhelming force. Could the Corsican muster 200,000? Could he arm them? Could he feed them? If the lead bullets did not destroy him, the gold bullets would soon make an end. He would be forced, like his neighbors, to come, hat in hand, for loans and, like them, to accept the banker's terms. He could not put his hands on £2,000,000, so empty was the treasury, and so depleted the nation's stock of metallic money. London waited with interest to see how the puzzle would be solved." End quote. Napoleon solved the puzzle quite simply by selling off some real estate. Those crazy Americans gave him £3,000,000 for a vast swamp called Louisiana. End quote. The section titled, A Plan to Destroy the United States, says the following, quote, "Napoleon did not want war, but he knew that Europe's financial rulers would not settle for peace, unless, of course, they were forced into it by the defeat of their puppet regimes, or, unless, somehow, it would be to their monetary advantage. It was in pursuit of the latter tactic that he threatened to take direct possession of Holland, which then was ruled by his brother, King Louis. Napoleon knew that the Dutch were heavily in debt to the English bankers. If Holland were to be annexed by France, this debt would never be repaid. So Napoleon made a proposal to England's bankers that, if they would convince the English government to accept peace with France, he would agree to leave Holland alone. The negotiations were handled by the banker Pierre César Labouchere, who was sent by the Dutch, and the English banker Sir Francis Baring, who was Labouchere's father-in-law. Although this was an attractive proposal to the bankers, at least on a short-term basis, it was still against their nature to forego the immense profits of war and mercantilism. They revised the proposal, therefore, to include a plan whereby both England and France would combine forces to destroy the newly independent United States and bring at least half of it, that is the industrial half, back under the domination of England. The incredible plan, conceived by the French banker Ouvard, called for military invasion and conquest followed by division of the spoils. England would receive the northern states, united with Canada, while the southern states would fall to France. Napoleon was to be tempted by offering him the awesome title of King of America. In his book Monarchy or Money Power, R. McNair Wilson states, quote, Le Boucher wrote to Baring on the 21st of March and enclosed a note for British Foreign Secretary Wellesley dictated by Ouvard, which ran, quote, From a conqueror, he, that is Napoleon, is becoming a preserver. The first result of his marriage with Marie-Louise will be that he will make an offer of peace to England. It is to this nation's, that is England's, interest to make peace, for it has the command of the sea. On the contrary, it is really in the interest of France to continue war, which allows her to expand indefinitely and make a fresh fleet, which cannot be done once peace is established. Why does not the English cabinet make a proposal to France to destroy the United States of America, and by making them again dependent on England, persuade Napoleon to lend his aid to destroy the life work of Louis XVI? It is to her, that is, England's interest to conclude peace and to flatter Napoleon's vanity by recognizing his work and his imperial title. End quote. The cabinet discussed the proposals and approved of them. Wellesley at once hurried to Baring's house to give him the good news. The Dutch would be able to pay and would be compelled to pay in gold. Unhappily, Napoleon found out what was afoot and took somewhat strong objections to the plan of a joint attack on the United States. He arrested Ouvard, dismissed and exiled Fouché, and published the whole story, to the grave distress of Wellesley and Baring. End quote. And so the battle lines were drawn. Napoleon had to be destroyed at all costs. To make this possible, the Bank of England created vast new amounts of fiat money to lend to the government so it could finance an overpowering army. A steady stream of gold flowed out of the country to finance the armies of Russia, Prussia, and Austria. The economy staggered once again under the load of war debt, and the little people paid the bill with hardly a grumble because they hadn't the slightest knowledge it was being charged to their account. End quote. It was in this manner that the Allied coalition was able to avoid bankruptcy and maintain the finances needed to defeat Napoleon's army and empire that threatened the entire debt-based banking system that sought to conquer the world.
The Napoleonic Wars, which had raged on land and sea for 11 years, seemed finally at an end. The death toll is unknown, but historians estimate that 2 to 3 million lives were lost across Europe. Most soldiers died not in battle, but from disease. Many thousands were left maimed and disfigured. For most of this period, Napoleon was master of Europe, imposing treaties on humbled enemies, redrawing frontiers, overthrowing old regimes, and making new kings. He was the last figure in history to combine total political power with frontline military genius, in the mould of Alexander and Caesar. But it seemed Napoleon's reign was to end in abject military defeat. However, exile on Elba did not prove to Napoleon's taste. In less than 10 months, he would return to France to fight one last great campaign to reclaim his throne.
From this point onwards, it became clear to the Masonically controlled Allied coalition that Napoleon Bonaparte was indeed a dangerous enemy and foe. Napoleon's ambition was to unify Europe as one empire that could stand against Great Britain, achieve lasting peace through economic independence, and free itself of the revolutionary ideals that ravaged France after the Enlightenment, for which he held Anglo-American Freemasonry responsible. Napoleon also recognized the Judeo-Masonic powers of finance that were pulling the strings, and thus took a harsh stance against the usurious debt-based banking system that had developed via the Rothschild banking family. Napoleon stated, quote, "When a government is dependent upon bankers for money, they, and not the leaders of the government, control the situation, since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes," end quote. Napoleon also stated, quote, "Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain." End quote. After escaping his exile in Elba in March of 1815, Napoleon would swiftly raise a new army to once again attempt to liberate his empire from Great Britain and her Masonically controlled allies. The Allied coalition could not afford to maintain yet another long-term war against Napoleon without risking bankruptcy. To the great fortune of the Allied coalition, Nathan Rothschild, who had started his banking firm in Great Britain in 1798, was in possession of the fortunes of Wilhelm IX of Hesse, who had abdicated the throne and escaped to Great Britain during the 1806 campaign by Napoleon. Nathaniel Rothschild offered to loan Wilhelm's fortunes at interest with the condition that Europe's Jews be emancipated and treated equally in the right to do business. Great Britain and the Allied coalition happily agreed to this, and it was this agreement that gave rise to the Rothschild banking firms that would open up just a few years later. This is how James Rothschild would later become the banker of Leopold I of Belgium, while Solomon Rothschild would lend money to the last Holy Roman Emperor, Francis II. And it was this same emperor who would later grant all five Rothschild brothers the noble title of Baron, thereby finally elevating the Rothschilds to nobility. Throughout the next decades, whenever the Rothschilds collapsed a European government through war or revolution, they would immediately provide loans at interest to raise new governments, thereby further making profits and gains. This would be exactly the case with the French Revolution of 1830, as well as the fall of the Holy Roman Empire. It would not be until the unexpected Second World War that the Rothschild banking family's power and influence would be challenged by an Austrian-German leader of Napoleon's caliber.
April 1814. For 10 years, one man has dominated Europe. Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of the French. Under his military genius, France conquered an empire that spanned the continent. But finally, he has been defeated by a grand coalition of his enemies. Napoleon is forced to abdicate and exiled to the tiny island of Elba. While the Bourbon monarchy is restored to France in the corpulent form of Louis XVIII. But rumors soon reach Napoleon that France would welcome his return. The French people have little love for the monarchy or its hangers-on, the very people whose excesses led to the French Revolution 25 years before. He also learns that at the Congress of Vienna, his enemies are locked in bitter dispute over the future of Europe. Napoleon decides to act. After just 10 months in exile, he returns to France, where the troops sent to arrest him rally to his cause instead. Most of France soon follows suit. But in Vienna, the coalition immediately put their differences to one side. They declare Napoleon an outlaw and mobilize their forces for war. The Battle of Waterloo was, in the words of the Duke of Wellington, a damned near-run thing. It was also one of the bloodiest battles of the age. Around 50,000 men were killed or wounded, 23,000 coalition casualties, 27,000 French. Due to an appalling shortage of medical care, many of the wounded were left lying on the battlefield for several days. Napoleon was utterly defeated. Unable to raise another army, he surrendered to the British. They transported him to a second exile, on the tiny, remote Atlantic island of St. Helena. This time there was no escape. He died there 6 years later. Waterloo marked the beginning of a period of relative peace in Europe. There were no wars between the great powers for 40 years, and the British would not fight on the continent for another 100 years, until the summer of 1914. Forty years after the battle, a pioneer in the new art of photography captured these remarkable images. They're veterans of Napoleon's armies, by then all old men in their 70s and 80s. Among them, Sergeant Tania of the Imperial Guard, Moray of the 2nd Regiment of Hussars, and Verlin of the 2nd Guard Lancers. These faces are a tantalising link to the dramatic events that shaped the course of history 2 centuries ago.
In modern times, it is not unusual for both sides of a war to be loaned money from the same privately owned central bank. Nothing in this world generates debt like war. A nation will borrow any amount to win, so naturally, if the loser is kept going to the last straw in a vain hope of winning, then more of the winner's resources will be used up and more loans taken out. Consequently, there will be more money made by the bankers, and even more amazingly, the loans are usually given by the bankers on the condition that the victor pays the debts left by the loser. Napoleon Bonaparte always refused to play by these rules. He envisioned a permanent peace in Europe where these bankers could no longer make profits by inciting unjust wars. In 1803, instead of borrowing from the bank, Napoleon sold territory west of the Mississippi to the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, for $3 million in gold, a deal known as the Louisiana Purchase. With $3 million gained, Napoleon quickly gathered together an army and set about conquering much of Europe, attempting to liberate it from the clutches of private bankers. Wherever Napoleon went, he found his opposition being financed by the Bank of England. All the while, the Bank of England was making huge profits as Prussia, Austria, and finally Russia all went heavily into debt trying to stop him. 4 years later, with the main French army in Russia, Nathan Rothschild took charge of a bold plan to smuggle a shipment of gold through France to finance an attack from Spain by the Duke of Wellington. Wellington's attack from the south and other defeats eventually forced Napoleon into exile. However, his 1815 return to Paris did not deter him from attempting the same ambitions again. Napoleon swore to fight the banking cartel through honest financial methods alone. By March of that year, Napoleon had equipped an army with the help of borrowed money from the Eobard Banking House of Paris. With 74,000 French troops led by Napoleon sizing up to meet 67,000 British and other European troops 200 miles northeast of Paris on June the 18th of 1815, it was a difficult one to call. Back in London, the real potential winner, Nathan Rothschild, was poised to strike in a bold plan to take control of the British stock market, the bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. Nathan, knowing that information is power, stationed his trusted agent named Rothworth near the battlefield. As soon as the battle was over, Rothworth quickly returned to London, delivering the news to Rothschild 24 hours ahead of Wellington's courier. A victory by Napoleon would have devastated Britain's financial system. Nathan stationed himself in his usual place next to an ancient pillar in the stock market. This powerful man was not without observers as he hung his head and began openly to sell huge numbers of British government bonds. Reading this to mean that Napoleon must have won, everyone started to sell their British bonds as well. The bottom fell out of the market until you couldn't hardly give them away. Meanwhile, Rothschild began to secretly buy up all the hugely devalued bonds at a fraction of what they were worth a few hours before. In this way, Nathan Rothschild captured more in one afternoon than the combined forces of Napoleon and Wellington had captured in their entire lifetime. The 19th century became known as the Age of the Rothschilds. It has been estimated that they controlled half of the world's wealth. While their wealth continues to increase today, they have managed to blend into the background, giving an impression that their power has waned. Today, they only apply the Rothschild name to a small fraction of the companies that they actually control. In the final years of his life, imprisoned on St. Helena, Napoleon would find no comfort in dwelling on the past. He found strength and peace only through his faith, prayer, and hunger to know his Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He kept a journal with frequent entries, and here are some of the things that Napoleon wrote. I know men, and I tell you, Jesus is not a mere man. He commands us to believe, and gives us no other reason than his words, I am God. Philosophers try to solve the mysteries of the universe by their empty dissertations. They are fools. They are like the infant that cries to the moon. Christ never hesitates. He speaks with authority. His ways are a mystery, but they subsist with their own force. He seeks and absolutely requires the love of men, the most difficult thing in the world to obtain. Alexander, Caesar, and Hannibal conquered the world, but had no friends. I myself am perhaps the only one of my day who loves Alexander, Caesar, and Hannibal. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and myself founded empires. But upon what? Upon force. Jesus founded his empire upon love, and at this very hour there are millions who would die for him. I myself have inspired multitudes with such affection that they would die for me, but my presence was necessary. Now that I am in St. Helena, where are my friends? I am forgotten, soon to return to the earth and to become food for the worms. What an abyss exists between my misery and the eternal kingdom of Christ, whose proclaimed love and adoration extends all over the earth. Is this death? I tell you that the death of Christ is the death of God. I tell you, Jesus Christ is God. Now that I am at St. Helena, now that I am alone chained upon this rock, who fights and wins empires for me? Who thinks of me? Who makes efforts for me in Europe? Where are my friends? Yes, two or three whom your fidelity immortalizes, you share, you console my exile. Paganism is the work of man. One can herewith read only our imbecility. What do these gods, who are so boastful, know more than any other mortals? These legislators, Greek or Roman, this Numa, this Lycurgus, these priests of India or Memphis, this Confucius, this Muhammad? Absolutely nothing. They have made a perfect chaos of morals. There is not one among them all who has said anything new in reference to our future destiny, to the soul, to the essence of God, to creation. We can say to the authors of every other religion, you are neither gods nor the agents of a deity. You are but missionaries of falsehood, molded from the same clay with the rest of us mortals. But it is not so with my Lord Jesus Christ. Everything in him astonishes me. His gospel, his apparition, his kingdom, his march across the ages and the realms. Here I see nothing mortal. The sciences and all philosophy avail nothing for salvation. Jesus came into the world to reveal the mysteries of heaven and the laws of the Spirit. All the scholastic scaffolding falls as an edifice ruined before one single word: faith. If he is not the truth, one is very excusable in being deceived, for everything in him is grand and worthy of God. The more I consider the gospel, the more I am assured that there is nothing there which is not beyond the march of events and above the human mind. They are about to take me and to crucify me, said Jesus. I shall be abandoned of all the world. Then my disciples will see me rise again. I shall ascend to heaven, and I shall send to them a spirit who will instruct them. The spirit of the cross will enable them to understand my gospel. In time, they will all believe it, they will preach it, and they will convert the world. The blood of Christians flowed in torrents. They died kissing the hand which slew them. The soul alone protested, while the body surrendered itself to all tortures. Everywhere Christians fell, and everywhere they triumphed. Can you conceive of Caesar as the eternal emperor of the Roman Senate, and from the depths of his mausoleum governing the empire, watching over the destinies of Rome? Such is the history of the conquest of the world by Christianity. Such is the power of the God of the Christians, and such is the perpetual miracle of the progress of the faith and of the government of his church. And this strange promise, so aptly called by Paul, the foolishness of the cross, this prediction of one miserably crucified, is literally accomplished, and it is not a day nor a battle which has decided it. Napoleon's will. Longwood Island of St. Helena, on the 15th day of April, 1821, quote, I die in the Apostolic Church in the bosom of which I was raised in more than 50 years ago. The consecrated vessels which have been in use at my chapel at Longwood, I direct Abbe Vignali to preserve them and to deliver them to my son when he shall reach the age of 16 years.
Get away. to let me in. Shattered windows and the sound of drums. People couldn't believe what I'd become. Revolutionary sway for my head on a silver plate. Just a puppet on a lonely string. Or who would ever want to be king? I hear Jerusalem bells ringing, Roman cavalry choirs are singing. Be my mirror, my sword and shield, my missionary. That was when I ruled the world. That was when I ruled the world.